Meeting's called to order. Motion to approve the minutes of February 13th. Anybody read them?
I'll move the minutes.
Representative Thiessen already raised his hand.
Okay.
Moves the minutes of February 13th. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Okay, first we have... First we have House File 560. Welcome to our committee, Representative Keel. I move House File 560 to be before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in our legacy omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very pleased to bring forward the what I guess I call the River Watch Bill. It is a program that students do, a wonderful educational opportunity. We have approximately 28 schools that participate in this program. But I am very fortunate today to have members from two of our schools that are participating. So I don't want to spend much time talking. I'd rather you hear from the schools. And we're going to start here. I all of a sudden blanked out. I know his mom, too.
Would you please give your name for the record, please?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Asher Kingery with the International Water Institute.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you for hearing from us. I'm a project specialist, so I work with the Riverwatch schools. The International Water Institute houses the Riverwatch program. And then our staff work one-on-one with schools in our area. So we cover the entire Red River Basin, provide equipment, training, and one-on-one support for those schools. And our goal is to work with as many students as possible and have them gain an understanding of watersheds. They will always live in a watershed, and no matter what career path they choose, they can interact with that watershed. We provide unique hands-on and field-based opportunities. And our program is very popular with, we are now approaching 300 students in our program. And now I guess I will be short as well and pass it on to the schools. We have one school from Campbell, Minnesota, and we have another school from very far up in the northwest at New Fulden. And we also have an EWE board member, George Sinner, here with us. So I will pass it over to Roy, the teacher from Campbell, Minnesota.
Welcome to our committee. Before you testify, give your name for the record.
My name is Roy Maeda, and I'm a teacher at Campbell Tinta High School, and I've been a Riverwatch advisor for about over 13 years now.
I'm Luke Gettle. I'm a sophomore at Campbell Tinta High School, and I've been a Riverwatch for 4 years.
My name is Micah Christensen, and I'm a sophomore at Campbell Tinta, and I've been in Riverwatch for about 3 years.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll have the students speak primarily. I've sort of made a point with my students that my goal in the program is to become the driver. They do the sampling, they do the analysis of the data, they do the presentation. I guide them when there's need for it, but just over the years, I've really been amazed at how much work the students do, how professional they are, just the results that we see. Very proud of the students we've had come out of Campbell Tinta through the Riverwatch program.
Yeah, I think Riverwatch is a really good learning experience because we sample for DO levels, pH levels, and turbidity levels at 11 sites along the Rabbit River, and if you would have asked me 4 years ago what DO or pH meant, I would have had no idea. So DO stands for dissolved oxygen, how much oxygen is in the water. pH is how acidic the water is, and turbidity means water clarity. So I've learned a lot of stuff about just sampling in general. And I've also learned a lot of team skills as well. Every year for the Riverwatch Forum, every school has to make a poster about a certain topic. And this year it was about the Rabbit River watershed, or just your watershed, so the Rabbit River watershed for us. And just me and Micah have to coordinate certain people to do certain topics on a poster. So I've learned a lot of team skills as well. And Micah will talk more about that.
And again, I'm Micah Christensen from Campbelltinta, and one of my favorite parts that we did with Riverwatch is just a couple weeks ago we did a lesson to the younger students in our school that aren't old enough to be in Riverwatch, and we educated them about our watershed and tried to persuade them to join when they're old enough. And that I've learned a lot from Riverwatch, and I never imagined that I'd ever do anything like this. I'm an athlete, and it didn't seem like my type of thing, but I love it. It's been a lot of fun, and I've gained a new respect for the rivers.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
It's one of the biggest things we have in Legacy is water, and clean water. Mm-hmm. And TMDLs was something that was introduced by a person from Moorhead, Maury Lanning. And I didn't know what TMDLs was until an hour presentation from him. I learned a lot about it. And I'm glad you're so interested in it. Minnesota has over 50% of our lakes that are already past federal standard, and we've got a few more to go. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go on record as noting that the two young men with the purple shirts, black ties, and black pants are in different schools and did not call each other this morning.
They both look very sharp.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Katie Melgard. I am a science teacher at Marshall County Central Schools. If you do not know where that is, we are 17 miles north of Thief River Falls, about 70 miles south of the Canadian border.
Welcome.
And then do you want to introduce yourselves?
Hi, my name is Morgan Skyam. I'm a sophomore at Marshall County Central High School in New Fulton, and this is my second year in Riverwatch.
And Mr. Chair, my name is Dalton Lofstrom. I'm a senior at Marshall County Central High School, and this is my fifth year in Riverwatch.
Well, thank you.
We have participated in Riverwatch as a school for about 10 or more years. I myself have only been helping for the past three, but I really enjoyed this program as providing an opportunity for students to go outside the classroom and really do real science. They have to collect the data. They have to make sure that it is something that they can replicate. They need to make sure it's good science and good data before we send it on. And it also provides them opportunities for connections with their environment. So they're out looking at the river at three different spots every month. We have opportunities where they go kayaking or canoeing along the river, and they really gain an appreciation for their local water.
I joined Riverwatch because my friend and I were looking for an activity that we could be in together but wasn't going to be a big time commitment. We both like science, so Riverwatch seemed like a good fit. Since then, I have learned a lot about our local rivers and the quality of those rivers. Some of my favorite things to do in Riverwatch are the activities we get to do with the elementary students. For example, last spring we went to a local state park with our fifth graders, and we launched canoes that they had decorated. And this fall, we gave a lesson to the fifth graders about our local rivers and what we do in Riverwatch. I really like doing these activities because I love working with kids that age.
Mr. Chair, Riverwatch has really expanded my horizons personally and given me opportunities to do many things that I wouldn't have been able to do if I wasn't in it. Two of these activities include kayaking, which we did last spring, and then canoeing this past fall. Besides actually learning how to canoe and kayak, I was made aware of the importance of learning by doing. Being in the waters with my peers and mentors taught me even more about water quality and monitoring, since we were up close to what we usually document. These extra activities are what many people, including me, enjoy most about Riverwatch, and it's through your continued support that we can take part in them time and time again. Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony. Just out of curiosity, what are you going to do with the money?
Well, this is my last year, so it won't personally affect me, but just so other people that want to do it can continue doing it.
Morgan, you know?
I think they were talking about doing some of the River of Dreams, like what I was talking about, the launching canoes with the younger.
The Red River is a very unique river, and you got to go way down south to find any place where the water runs north like it does up where you live, and that's where I live. We have 78 miles where the water runs north from Iowa into Mankato. And then from Mankato to the Mississippi River up here in the cities. So it's kind of fun that not many places where water flows north. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for the some of the youth that are here today. Just wondering, you know, sometimes when you're watching, it sounds like a great program, so the River Watch, what you're... Just wondering if it's motivating to, or if you've noticed anything that makes you want to, calls you to action. I mean, is there anything in the water that says we better deal with this as a state, or what are the big impacts that are causing the, I guess there's, you know, the damage maybe if there will, or is there concerns that you have, or anything that might call you to action?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I've always felt like I wanted to like help the environment and all that, and I think Riverwatch has renewed an interest in that even more. So I think I just want to do more for the environment now because I've been in it, and it's renewed an interest in me. So.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Representative Keel or an advisor can answer. Where has previous funding come from?
I'm just making sure that I had it right. It has come in the past from the Clean Water Fund, which I'm sure, Representative Erdahl, you are fully aware of. And it does, when you ask where the money goes and what is going on, they have investments in different projects. And remember, this is 28 different school districts. So there is all kinds of different things that they do, canoeing, so that they have learned the appreciation of the rivers that they work on. And just being able to observe what happens on those rivers. And in some cases, if there's enough water, we were discussing this earlier, little creeks or cricks, depending on where you come from, I guess. I call it Burnham Creek, and I grew up on it. So, but there's a lot of interest in seeing how the water changes, especially up in the northwest area of the River Valley, because we are flat. Generally, you can pour water on a table, and it would move about the same as it does in the Red River. So it is unique. And but we do have someone else here that I would like to bring forward too. If you have any other questions of students first.
Students did a wonderful job. I can't think any members have any questions for the students or no.
Okay, we'll bring the next testifier up then, if that's all right, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Thank you for coming.
We're honored to also have Mr. George Sinner, who was a legislator in North Dakota, but is now, I'll let you tell the title that you hold within the watershed there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is George Sinner. I am a senior vice president with a bank in Fargo. I have been active with the International Water Institute on their board of directors for a couple of years. One of the interests that I got in getting into this sort of work was the International Water Institute was partially founded by my father some 15 to 20 years ago. And I grew up on a farm in rural Cass County, have fought floods all of my life, as many of you who lived in the valley also have. But I came today to talk about this program and what its importance is, in the future of our youth, of our society. We all know the importance of clean water. And we know this program educates our youth as the importance of clean water. And it also creates an interest in these young people in following up with maybe future careers in water quality, water education, and maybe even engineering. We don't know that. But we also understand, many in this committee, understand the importance of water in our economy in Minnesota and in North Dakota. Water is a very, very important piece of driving tourism, agriculture, all sorts of things in our state and the states around us. I grew up in a rural community, but we always had a lake home in Minnesota. I've been going to Minnesota lakes all of my life around the Detroit Lakes area, and I can tell you that over the course of my life, I have seen the lakes cleaned up, partially because of the work that this committee does and this state has done, and I can tell you I am deeply grateful. But we don't know how many more generations will be living on this planet, but in order to sustain life on this planet, we must have clean water. This program helps with that process, and I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being here. Any questions from the members? Seeing none, I will renew Representative Keel's motion to have my motion to have House File 560 laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a good presentation. The kids did a great job. We're honored to have a former legislator from North Dakota. Yeah, I guess I'm next. Huh? Oh, Parks and Trails. We'll have Parks and Trails next. Welcome to our committee. Would you please give your name for your record and continue with your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Erica Rivers. I'm the director of Minnesota State Parks and Trails. And let's get the presentation up here for you. Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to present some of the information about the great work that's being done across the state of Minnesota with the Parks and Trails legacy funds. I'm here today as one of three colleagues that's part of advancing a vision for a well-integrated and world-class system of regional parks and trails. And so I'd like to leave this opportunity to my colleagues to introduce themselves as well.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emmett Mullen, and I'm the manager of the Metropolitan Regional Parks Unit at the Metropolitan Council.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Renee Mattson. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission.
And again, my name is Erica Rivers. I'm responsible for managing Minnesota's state parks and trails system. It's about 75 state parks and recreation areas and 25 state trails across the system. We together represent the leadership of the three implementing agencies that are responsible for the investments that are made with the legacy funds. And we've been working very closely together over the course of the last 6 years to coordinate the legacy investments for Minnesota's great system of parks and trails.
Thank you. With the passage of the Legacy Amendment in 2008, the state legislature set expectations for the creation of a 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan. The planning process had extensive public outreach. It was an 18-month process. There were 17 statewide listening workshops throughout Minnesota, outreach to thousands of people, including a really intentional effort to engage young people and youth. There was also extensive web input. And the focus was on the Parks and Trails Legacy Plan is on parks and trails of regional and state significance. So that's just the intent of this schematic here. The focus is really on that state parks and regional parks. The 25-year legacy plan set a powerful vision. So it's by 2035, our world-class parks and trails connect everyone to the outdoors. They inspire a legacy of stewardship for the natural world, and they allow Minnesotans to experience the full range of benefits for outdoor recreation. The plan directed the agencies to work together and collaborate. I think that's why we're here today. And from this 17-member Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee also emerged, and this is a committee that provides guidance with the implementation of the legacy plan.
The legacy plan also set a very important framework for the investment across the four pillars in the plan. Those four pillars are connecting people with the outdoors, which is an incredibly important pillar for building wonderful parks and trails throughout the state of Minnesota for people to enjoy. It's rather pointless if we can't engage people to be out in the outdoors experiencing it. So we use this as a way to connect people through programs in the parks, engagement, multicultural Minnesotans, and also the focus on youth and our next generation and hopefully getting them away from their computer screens out into something a little bit more meaningful, or at least I think we'd all agree it's more meaningful, although I guess we'll stop the lecturing there since it's an ongoing point. But connecting people is certainly an important pillar. Also acquiring land and creating opportunities. It's important to pursue the acquisitions where necessary to complete infills in parks, particularly key connections between communities on trails, linking those important communities with the parks and trails where we're missing those pieces of connections, preserving the priority natural or cultural resources, and also the high-priority development projects that encourage outdoor recreation, and that participation through the connecting people with the outdoors piece, also very important. Taking care of what we have, I think we can all agree that our much-loved resources, it's very important to keep those much-loved resources in great working order through repair and rehabilitation. That's something we all work very hard on to maintain that piece. And then finally, coordinating with partners, which is why the three of us are here today, and certainly I appreciate their participation, being from Greater Minnesota and being a staff of one. Having my partners is incredibly helpful and meaningful for us so that we can continue to do more work on the grant side of things and less on the administration side of things. So thanks to our partners here.
Thank you, Renee. You know, I think it is really important to underscore the point that Renee just made, that we do all have a very collegial, collaborative relationship now between the three implementing agencies, the Minnesota DNR, Met Council, and Greater Minnesota. Some of the members of this committee that have been here for some time will recall that this was not always the case. Back in 2011 and 2012, there was something of a food fight, I would say, that was going on between the implementing agencies, positioning themselves for different portions of the funding. And as a result of this committee actually several years ago in 2012 asked the implementing agencies, all three of us, to get together and fix this issue, to work together to determine a funding strategy for three biennia that would make reasonable investments with these Parks and Trails legacy funds in a way that everybody could be very proud of after its 25 years. And the result of that was what we call the 40-40-20 split, for any of those of you that are new to the committee and maybe aren't familiar with it. And it's the culmination of many, many months of work in this report that was produced by the implementing agencies. We each appointed three people to participate in a fairly prolonged, about six-month negotiation, where we ultimately agreed that it would be reasonable for the course of three biennia to follow the instructions from the Parks and Trails Legacy Plan and divvy up these funds in a manner that would be 40% to Metropolitan Parks, 40% to DNR State Parks and Trails, and 20% to Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails. So I think the important point to underscore here is one of the reasons there was some deal of conflict in the past is there was an attempt, I think, to try to find an apples-to-apples comparison using a very formulaic approach to each of these systems. But each of these systems is very different in our approaches and in the audiences that we serve. So we think it's really important that each of us have an opportunity here today to talk to you about how we each choose select the legacy projects and investments that we're going to make from our own perspectives. And so I'll start out with the investments that we're proposing in fiscal 18-19 with Minnesota State Parks and Trails. So up here on the monitors, you'll see between fiscal years 10 and 17, the legacy appropriations that Minnesota State Parks and Trails have used in their basic breakup. And again, back to Renee Mattson's point, this is all coming based on the four pillars that are defined in this Parks and Trails Legacy Plan from 2011. So over time, you'll see the smallest piece of pie up there is about $1.9 million. This is roughly 1%. We call it an off-the-top appropriation for coordinating with our partners, and I'll talk about that in a minute. About 16% historically is in that dark blue slice of pie, which is from the connecting people to the outdoors pillar. About nearly 30% is for acquiring land and creating new opportunities pillar. And finally, the largest chunk there, as Ms. Madsen said, is really about investing in and taking care of what we already have, about 55% historically. In terms of that 1% off the top connecting, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources really the fiscal agent for these dollars that are used by all three implementing agencies to do really good work that creates a seamless system of parks and trails across our landscape. As many of you know, most recreationalists in Minnesota don't really necessarily care if they're in a regional park or a state park. They just care about the quality of the resources that are there, and they care about whether or not the trail is well-maintained and taken care of. So there's a great need to ensure that we create a lot of connectivity between all of these different kinds of units so that Minnesotans can experience a very unified experience. So these funds are used for three primary things. One is for support for the Legacy Advisory Committee. This is a 17-member committee that was appointed with representation from Greater Minnesota, Metropolitan Parks and Trails, as well as Minnesota DNR. And then we have 8 ad hoc members, and those ad hoc members are selected by the implementing agencies to ensure that we have lots of different perspectives, diverse perspectives on the Legacy Advisory Committee to ensure that we're representing well Minnesotans and their interests in the outdoors. We also use this coordinating with partners to help us do coordinated research between the systems, getting more information about how our various systems are used, who's using them, how satisfied they are with them, and what kinds of investments they would like to see in the future. And then finally, a major project that we have been working on in the last biennium is an integrated website. And this is to the point of oftentimes folks don't really care if they're in a regional park or a state park. They just want to have a good experience. And the opportunity here is that we use information technology, a scaffolding that was developed by Minnesota Minute that will create a standard place and format for all the kinds of information coming from Greater Minnesota, Metropolitan Parks and Trails, and DNR, so that we create a very user-friendly user face on the web that will allow people to select the opportunities that they're looking for across our systems. In terms of the connecting people to the outdoors, historically we've spent about 13% making investments in this very important pillar. The slide you see here, we've got is illustrative of the work that's been done. You'll notice that since Legacy, since 2012, we have been able to make some significant investments in connecting people to the outdoors, and we feel pretty strongly that we are seeing this increase in usership within our state parks and trails as a result of these critical investments. Over the past year, we have also had a very strong interest in and emphasis on connecting traditionally underserved people to our outdoors. The top picture there, we are celebrating the 125th anniversary of Minnesota State Parks and Trails with the Fond du Lac Band through a drumming ceremony and picnic that we held at Jay Cook State Park. And on the bottom, you'll notice a part of our multicultural media initiative, Univision, reaching out to Latino-Hispanic populations to encourage them to get outdoors and visit our state parks and trails. This connecting pillar is also the core part of our support for our naturalist program within the Department of Natural Resources for our state parks and trails. We invest heavily in supporting programming that does just what this young man that was here before testifying to the water, connecting kids to the outdoors, connecting young people to the outdoors, and creating stewards for the next generation. And all those interpretive programs typically see 300,000 people through those programs every year. The third pillar is this acquire land and create new opportunities. Historically, has been about 30% of the legacy fund, about 27%. Here we're really talking about two things, both acquiring land in holdings, as Ms. Mattson was talking about earlier, as well as creating new opportunities. And the pictures here show two projects we're very proud of. One is Whitewater State Park on the top, a new campground and a group center down at the Whitewater State Park. Here's a situation with where we have moved a campground out of a floodplain and up onto higher ground. And as we have done that, the new opportunity part of this is that we're recognizing that lots of groups in Minnesota are wanting to recreate outdoors, camp in multi-generational groups. And so the group camp here was designed especially for tenters and RVers to be together in one space and with higher level of amenities. And the second also represents the picture on the bottom, fat tire biking. This is particular picture is taken at Cuyuna Country State Recreation Area, up just outside of Crosby, Minnesota. We have an outstanding partnership with a group of volunteers that form a mountain bike crew, and we're investing in additional mountain biking and fat tire biking trails there. Fat tire biking is one of those outdoor recreation activities that's increasing in popularity, and we're investing these important funds in continuing to find opportunities for this. The biggest part of our legacy funds are used to invest in taking care of what we have, about 55% historically to do that. Again, two different kinds of investments are made here. In the blue, you'll see about 20% is on our natural resource program, ensuring that we maintain the natural resources in our state parks and along our state trails. That are the reason people are coming to visit these special places to begin with. And then the second is really the bigger piece of pie, about 80% now, is really focused on taking care of what we have. Minnesota State Parks and Trails had two real bubbles of development over their history, one in the 1930s, one in the second in the 1960s. So these buildings are between 60 and 90 years old now. The infrastructure that supports them are of similar age, and they need reinvestment right now to continue to provide the excellent public services that we endeavor to in these parks and trails. In terms of how we make decisions, Minnesota State Parks and Trails starts evaluating what sorts of legacy investments we would like to make back about a year ago in March of 2016. And we begin the process with an early review and strategic discussions looking at all the various plans that guide our work. The 25-year legacy plan with the priorities that are outlined there, the Minnesota State Parks and Trails System Plan, the Commissioner, DNR Commissioner's Conservations at Works Plan, and make sure that what we're doing is in alignment with those plans. We then took some initial proposals and ideas back to the Legacy Advisory Committee in June and had a presentation to them to ensure that they were supportive and happy with the directions we were proposing for future investment in the next biennium. Fine-tune those into a set of projects and priorities here in September, November, and then produced a report that I hope this committee has already seen, which all three implementing agencies produce every biennium to propose how we invest those funds into the next biennium. And just a final point, as we look at the priority lists that exist within the State Parks and Trails legacy report, one of the last pages of the report is a list of projects that we propose. They are guided by system plan investments. This is a the guiding document we use with State Parks and Trails to determine how we invest into the future. We've instead of trying to be all things to all people in all places, Minnesota State Parks and Trails is trying to be very disciplined in a differentiated system of rustic, core, and destination parks and being disciplined in how we make those investments using legacy funds in those categories as well.
Thank you for that good testimony. Next.
Thanks, Erica. Again, I'm Renee Mattson. I'm the Executive Director and of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. The commission came into being in 2013, so we're a relatively new organization. And as I like to point out to everyone, I got to swoop in about a year and a half ago. I was hired by the commission to be our executive director after this really hard-working group of volunteers did all of the heavy lifting. I got to come in when the fund had started, when we were developing the system plan. But all the credit goes to a group of individuals who really felt strongly about promoting the growth and enhancement of parks and trails in Greater Minnesota. So it's great fun to be part of that organization, and I'm thrilled to be the face representing them, particularly here today. Our work process is fairly straightforward. As I said, being a small and fairly new organization, we take a look at what we're doing on a constant basis because we're not shackled by anything other than our enabling legislation, and we're constantly looking at ways we can serve our constituents better. So currently, our guiding document is a strategic plan that outlines the work that we're going to be doing in Greater Minnesota, developing a cohesive system of parks and trails. It's currently at 47 parks and trails regionally designated throughout the state, and that regional designation is important because it allows those communities who have achieved that designation, which is really the high bar, to apply for funding through the legacy funding. Thank you. See, we work so well together as an organization. The interesting thing about our organization is that we neither own nor manage any of our 47 assets. We are simply the conduits for them to assist them in planning, provide the backup where necessary, promote them. Certainly that's an important piece. And our integrated website that we'll be launching here come summer for the three agencies is going to be an enormous help to all of those organizations. As you might imagine, 47 different parks and trails throughout the state don't all have the same resources or ability to promote themselves. And again, back to that connecting piece, connecting people to the outdoors, it's important for us to get people out into those parks and trails. And one of the very important things we can do for them is help them promote themselves. And the new website is going to be an enormous help to them as well as everyone else.
Let me get this straight. You're all three going to share the same website?
We are.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that good? It's particularly good for me since we don't have one that does that. So
you only get 20%. You really pay.
So I'm only going to get 20% of our parks and trails on this first year. But that will be a great help to our organization as well. Currently, we are on the third. We've just, completed the second of our own self-directed funding cycles, and we have recommendations in for the commission to fund another 12 projects to really help and enhance the necessary work for our parks and trails in Greater Minnesota. It's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of learning, and we have done some interesting work with what we call prototype projects that fit neither well nor they just don't fit into the normal boxes. So we've been able to help communities with some planning, help them take their master plans one step more to be able to enhance them and make better funding applications. So we're doing some important and some unique work, and I'm really proud to be the representative of the commission and pleased to be here for
this today, and we'll take questions, of course, at the end as a group. But thank you.
Emmett. Next we have...
I'm Emmett Mullen again with the Metropolitan Council, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for having us today. On behalf of the 10 regional park implementing agencies, two of whom are with me today, we appreciate you scheduling this hearing. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, the Twin Cities metropolitan area was really growing. And the 1974 legislature created the Metropolitan Parks Act in response to this growth in the metropolitan area, because they were looking at the incredible resources that existed in the seven county area, and that the ability for people to access those recesses was becoming more and more limited with the growth. So this 1974 Metropolitan Parks Act established the regional park system, and it authorized the Metropolitan Council to develop a regional parks policy plan that would identify land, and together with states, parks, and trails, would reasonably meet the outdoor recreation needs of the metropolitan area. Here's a map of the metropolitan region with our 10 regional park partners identified. The Metropolitan Council serves as the coordinating body with the Metropolitan Regional Park System and the 10 regional park partner agencies. We're charged with long-range planning, serving as the fiscal agent for the system as a whole. In that way, our role differs with the Minnesota DNR, who actually administer and operate state parks and trails in the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition. The Met Council, we don't own or operate any parks and trails, and we pass through 100% of the legacy dollars directly to our 10 agencies. There are four types of units within the Metropolitan Regional Park System. They're identified here. Regional parks, which are probably the most notable or commonly understood, are, you know, in between 100 and 500 acres in size. The park reserves are really large parks. There's regional trails, and then there's special recreation features, which really fit a unique recreation niche, such as the Como Zoo. Thanks, Claire. The Metropolitan Regional Park System serves the region as well as the state and beyond. This chart illustrates the use of our system, sort of breaking down the visits between local visits and regional visits, as well as visits from greater Minnesota and out of state. Here's a chart that just demonstrates the popularity of the Metropolitan Regional Park System. The most recent 2015 visitor survey found that there were more than 47 million visits to the Metropolitan Regional Park System. So it's really a system that is loved by many. For the Metropolitan Regional Park System, Parks and Trails Legacy Funds are distributed by legislative formula. So 90% of the funds are distributed directly to the agencies, and the formula takes into account things like the relative size of each of the implementing agencies' parks, the number of local people they serve, the number of non-local people they serve, and then how much each agency contributes to run their systems. The remaining 10% provides funding for land acquisition, each agency, when there is land acquisition, contributes 25% of the acquisition costs. The Metropolitan Council contributes 30% in regional bonds, and then legacy funds supply 45% of the cost. So these funds are distributed on a first-come, first-served basis. And this is my last slide before we get to Claire and Steve. And this just recognizes that the Parks and Trails Legacy Plan, the plan that we talked about earlier, really does serve as our foundational document. It is for the metropolitan regional system, and it's the one thing that we all share in common. We're active members of the Legacy Advisory Committee, and we're committed to implementing the vision in this 25-year plan. With that, I'd like to now pass it to my partners.
Representative Thiessen has a question.
Oh, excuse me.
No, not at all. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had are the Chain of Lakes in Minneapolis part of the regional park system?
Yes. The Chain of Lakes is one that's managed by the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, as you know, and that comprises Lake Harriet and Lake Calhoun.
Right. Thank you. And that's what my question is. So when I run around Lake Harriet, how does that count as a visitor? How do you do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, when you run around Lake Harriet, you would be counted as one visitor in the regional park system. So, as you know...
each time? Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Well, if you do it slow enough, it's too big.
You would only be counted one time for each visit.
For each visit, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I think we should have a race between Representative Lilly and Thiessen.
No.
Who gets around there first? Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mullen, could you tell me those percentages again? The 40% was one, I didn't get the others.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, are you asking about the distribution of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund between DNR, Greater Minnesota, and the Metropolitan Regional Park System? That would be 40% for the Minnesota DNR, 40% for the Metropolitan Regional Park System, and 20% for the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coalition.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what the 4% for out-of-state is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, 4% of all visitors to the Metropolitan Regional Park System actually come from outside of Minnesota. So those would be residents that reside outside of Minnesota.
Representative Green.
And that kind of goes back to the question that Representative Thiessen asked. How do you count them? I mean, do they register when they come in? In the morning, mm-hmm. and that's how you get the numbers? Or if someone jogs around the lake once a day, then they're counted once a day. How are they always registered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green. Our visitor use estimate is a survey that's conducted between Memorial Day and Labor Day every year, and it's done annually. And then there are extrapolations done to calculate use during the different seasons, so summer, fall, winter, and spring. And calculation is done annually. It's done on a 4-year average, and if you need more information than that, Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I could provide that.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I'm not going to keep on with questions. We have a long day, but the information on who gets the surveys, where do you send them to find out if they're from out of state? If you're not doing a sign-in sheet, then you must be getting those from somewhere. So I'd like that information. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Green and Mr. Chair. I will get that information and send it to you.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm Claire Roebling.
How are you doing? Well,
thank you. I'm the Communications and Legislative Coordinator for Scott County. And I just wanted to share with you some of the things that Scott County does with our appropriation from the Legacy Fund. We've been putting together master plans, and we've had a lot of community involvement with that from residents and local elected officials and recreation groups. And this has led to the expansion in several of our parks. We are a growing county, and we are a young county, so our parks are loved to death. We have two new parks that have recently opened, and one is Cedar Lake Farm Regional Park, and it just had a grand reopening. They did a lot of work there using some of this legacy funding, and they did some super trails through there that made it very handicap accessible for a program we have out there that's called Let's Go Fishing. And we have this big pontoon that sits out there, and they bring in people from nursing homes and senior centers and veterans facilities and some youth groups, but focusing on people especially with disabilities. I had the chance to go out one day with them, and I baited a lot of hooks. And you should have seen the excitement of the folks who were catching these fish. They weren't real big that day, but it didn't matter. They were catching fish. And then we have handicapped accessible bathrooms that were just installed there, which really accommodated the folks who were coming out there for the Let's Go Fishing rides and fishing. And then we also have a new canoe and kayak launch area. And I guess we thought that's really what it would be for, but it ended up that the paddleboarders are taking over the world. That's become a very popular activity, and there's a lot of them out there. They can rent them there or bring their own. It's a popular activity. And then I had my six-year-old granddaughter was going out for one of the youth camps out there. It's just a three-day camp to expose kids to some outdoor activities. And I know my daughter was a little worried, like, what if the bugs are too bad, or if it gets too hot, or the storms, where would they go? And they had just added a new kind of big classroom space with air conditioning where they could have taken the children into if they needed to get them out of the heat and the bugs. But as it turned out, the weather was perfect. My granddaughter loved it, and she is waiting to go back this summer because it was such a good experience for her and the other little campers. And then we had another park that also was Spring Lake Regional Park. It's between Prior Lake and Shakopee. And this one has trails that the city has going right into the park. So you're driving along or walking along a city street trail, and then it takes you into this beautiful natural environment that's the regional park. And that's been a big hit with people in our area. But the biggest hit has probably been the off-leash pet area, because it seems like almost everybody has a dog. And if you've been outdoor knocking, and I used to do that in my former profession, you know that the dogs usually beat the owners to the door, and there seems to be one at every house. And so they like to get them outside, and a lot of people take them out and let them run around in these nice park areas that we developed for that. And then we also have some land that we've been acquiring in the Blakely Bluff area. It's out by Belle Plaine. And this is very environmentally sensitive bluff area that had some erosion issues, especially in 2014 when we had about 11 inches of rain that fell in that area. And this is being acquired. It's beautiful hardwood area, which was one of the problems because some of those big trees couldn't stay in the bluffs, and they slid down and took everything with them. But we're developing a nice park area that will preserve that area and let people enjoy that for many, many, many years to come, we hope. But those are some of the things we're doing, and we certainly appreciate the legacy funding that we receive for that.
Welcome. We can give you a name for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Steve Sullivan. I'm the Parks Director with Dakota County. Thank you for having us here today. What I'd like to do is share how really Parks and Trails legacy has made a difference in the metro area, in particular Dakota County, but also in people's lives, and provide you some examples of projects that have been funded with Parks and Trails legacy, and some of the benefits. I hope also to provide some of the performa, some of the outcomes that have occurred, so you can test my premise here that it truly has made a difference. What it has done is that, as Claire mentioned, we've acquired some really key parcels that have high-quality natural resources within Dakota County. And we've also restored prairies and woodlands, so the ecologic health of our open space is better. And we've filled gaps, so people are able to do those things that are most popular in the outdoors. And one of the examples I'd like to provide to you is three projects, and I'll be quick with them, that relates to the Mississippi.
We have five bills after you're finished.
I'll be extremely quick, Chair. Thank you. The first is on the Mississippi River Regional Trail. The trail extends from St. Paul to Hastings. It's 29 miles long, and it provides the opportunity for people to have access to the Mississippi River and to enjoy one of the world's greatest rivers. And there's three gaps within that, and I want you to know Parks and Trails legacy is fulfilling, is funding two of those three gaps. And the first I'd like to speak to is that yellow stretch that you see on the north end there. We're working with St. Paul. We ended up getting a federal grant of $5 million. Dakota County's share is less than that. And we'll be building that trail in 2018. And what that does is it connects from Harriet Island to South St. Paul, and then there's a trail that extends south into Dakota County. Majority of the trail is in place. The second gap I'd like to mention is the purple link that you see there. We're working with the DNR, and we're connecting from the Pine Bend Science and Natural Area south towards Hastings. In that case, we've received in 2017 $370,000 of Parks and Trails funds, and we're getting $2 million of federal funds. That prior project, just to give you an idea in terms of fiscal stewardship, $500,000 of Parks and Trails fund, and Dakota County's share was $3 million of federal funds. And the third segment, I want you to know we're working on it. We have a federal grant, and we'll be asking for a bonding request this year. Moving on to the next project on the Mississippi River Regional Trail is... this is the Pine Bend Trailhead. It's located, it's the first trailhead of a regional trail within a DNR Science and Natural Area. It shows that Parks and Trails is having organizations work differently together. And this will provide access both to the Science and Natural Area, but it will also provide access to the Mississippi River Regional Trail. In this case, it's $1 million worth of outside funding and $410,000 of Parks and Trails funds. So what this does, if you look at those three projects alone, it's $1.3 million of Parks and Trails funds, and it's leveraging over $6 million of other funds. So it's working well and getting things done and doing things that people like to do in terms of their recreation. Quickly on this, as Claire mentioned, Dakota County is a growing park system. We have 200 miles of greenway we're trying to install, and the metro area has some of the best of the best parkland as part of this regional system, and it allows us to acquire it and protect it. And moving on, for the sake of time, for my last slide, I think this is one of the most important aspects of Parks and Trails Legacy Funds. Since 2011, because of Parks and Trails Legacy Funds, we've been able to protect, restore, and manage natural resources within our parks and greenways. It's just not enough to acquire the land. One needs to take care of it. And in many cases, parkland, once it's acquired, it doesn't get actively managed. And as you know, there's invasives such as buckthorns, that some of the native plant material is diminishing. We're not seeing regeneration of oak trees. And as a result of Parks and Trails funds, along with Conservation Partner Legacy Funds and county funds, we have 500 acres of prairie that's currently being managed. 900 acres is currently under restoration, and 600 acres of buckthorn is currently being managed. I just had a chance to speak to the director in Three Rivers. Because of Parks and Trails Legacy, Conservation Legacy Funds, one of their projects alone is restoring 1,000 acres of parkland. So it's an opportunity to take care of what we have. In summary, Parks and Trails Legacy Funds has made a difference. Regional park agencies are able to focus on what are the highest priority improvements within their system. Their boards are giving directions through their CIP, and we're able, through local decision-making, mm-hmm. to be able to improve our park system. The quality of outdoor recreation is much more responsive to what people want. And the last thing is that the ecologic health of the regional park system is being improved.
Well, thank you very much for an enlightening presentation. Anybody got any questions they want to ask? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. Learned all kinds of things about fun parks and trails, and I do enjoy the metro parks.
Thank you, Mr. Rivera.
And next we have me.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Are we still on Parks and Trails?
No.
There's a couple people who would like a minute or two.
Oh, we have one other person. Would anybody in the audience like to talk about Parks and Trails? Please come up and give your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Bobeer. I'm from Tacoma Township in McLeod County.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I need to represent my representative, Dean Erdahl, as my representative for that township.
I'll pray for you.
Thank you. So, I guess, first of all, we had a great presentation. I just heard on the Parks and Trail Committee and so forth, and I have had an occasion to visit Sartell for a couple of their meetings last fall, and I got to tell you, I think they're doing a good job on a very complex subject, as I mentioned to them then.
Very well.
I think the one thing that they're missing, though, is they're not considering there's two sides of every story, and there's a story that's not being reflected, and part of which is on trails. It's who makes the decision and recommendation, who wants it. I've got a front page here. I didn't realize this morning when I left work I'd be downtown here today, so forgive me. I only have paper copies. But I've got a front page of the Hutchinson Leader from April 24th. Township says stop the paving, and I'll leave this for whoever wants it. Basically, that basically reported that at that time, last spring, 10 out of 14 townships in McLeod County passed resolutions asking for a three-year suspension of more paved trails. That was even before the Dakota Trail and anything was even approved. Unfortunately, the townships haven't been listened to, and our commissioners, by a split vote, this is not unanimous, it's a very contentious issue in our county, 3-2, basically passed these bills and passed the funding application for Dakota Rail. And then after that, after it passed, we went back to, there's some more output from townships, three more townships signed on. So I'm here to report that we have 13 out of 14 townships, which I think is unprecedented, do not want to proceed with paving of the Dakota Trail. That's one of the 12 trails in your thing for this year. We're not a bunch of wackos or whatever. We understand there's free money or whatever. But what's being proposed is a paved trail that we have a great deal of concern against. And kind of historically, we've only got two trails in our county. One's Loose Lane Trail. That was kind of a real fast under-the-covers thing. That got paved without us knowing about it.
That's a big long one, right?
What's that?
That's a big long one?
It is, right. And it matches up to the unpaved Loose Lane Trail in Carver County, which, again, would have made a lot more sense to make them both crush gravel, but that thing got a life of its own. So anyway, now we have one trail left, Dakota Trail. And when this decision is made, if it's paved, you know, that's it. It's not like you're going to change your mind in a year or two. McLeod County is a rural area. It's 81% farmland. We're not a metro area. And I don't know if any of you folks have the opportunity to come to our McLeod County Fair in August. It's phenomenal. We got wonderful fairgrounds. We're an agricultural area. We have horses. We've got almost 500 horses in McLeod County. These people pay about $3,000 a year to feed, take care of their horses, and they would like a place to ride in the trail. Unfortunately, due to Loose Lane Trail getting paved over, and again, I'm sorry, I don't have video for you. This is a picture of the paved Loose Lane Trail on the west side of Hutchinson, and this creek here is supposed to be the side trail that horses are supposed to use. It's unusable. On the east side of Hutchinson, similar situation. This is a farmer's area here. Again, wetlands here that used to be the trail. And so the horses basically don't have the trail they used to have. And the Dakota Trail, as it's currently written right now, excludes horses, and it's going to get paved. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I guess the townships have voted on this. I regret to have to come to St. Paul because we can't, you know, whatever, get attention in the public.
In Martin County, our townships don't have to vote on it because we don't have any trails.
Say it again?
In Martin County, we don't have to vote on it because we don't have any trails.
Okay, well, that's good. But anyway, I guess
we want them.
Huh?
We want them.
Okay. Well, in that case, we've got some reasons why. And again, it's not the Rantai Trail, maybe a gravel trail or something that includes horses. That's more for representative or agricultural area is what we're asking for. So kind of a, again, and we, in order to get to file for this Dakota Trail, the county signed up for 20 years of maintenance as well. So, I mean, we've got our stick in the game here for a long time. So I guess with that in mind, I got two requests of you. Number one, is in the future, when this shouldn't be a late backing thing. This should really be a requirement up front, is to have the townships involved with the application process. And they're not currently. They're ignored. And our townships in our area are bigger than some of our little towny cities. And the second thing, again, is for this year, again, the way it's written right now, to pave trails, we're kind of asking you to pull this off and not address it. And I'd be happy to send all these petitions and so forth to you. And the last thing on usage, last fall they came out with friendly usage on the Dakota Trail. And it's not like that thing was not used before. People rode horses, they took their dogs out, there was walkers and runners. They were connected to the outdoors, to coin the phrase here. But they did a snapshot in the high season of July on bike ship riding on Loose Line Trail. And using automated counters, they got 34 per day at the midpoint between Hutchinson and Silver Lake. So because it's automated, you assume that they're not getting picked up and going back. It's maybe 17 people a day. And again, is this really a good use of our taxpayers' money to pave another trail when the first one has got utilization levels like that?
Mm-hmm. Representative Guineas.
Yes. Thank you. If you would share with us the discussions that the townships had about two things. One, how meeting the needs of folks who where trails wouldn't be readily accessible because they're handicapped in some way. And secondly, for folks who are older and don't navigate rocks as well as they would a paved trail. So sure. Tell me about the discussions you all had.
Sure. I don't believe, to my knowledge, the townships weren't discussing things like that, but I think to answer your question, I will say we're really blessed. The city of Hutchinson has fantastic trails. They use them a lot. They're paved. They're down by the river. I can't remember how many mileage it is, like 50, 60 miles of paved trails in Hutchinson. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly open to people with wheelchairs and things like that. And again, I don't know, if you look at how rural this area is, I'd be worried about somebody alone being out there, you know, unescorted, right? It may be safer for somebody that is challenged to be in a metro area where there is more traffic. But again, wonderful, beautiful areas around the dam there and in the city. And again, I'd look at the numbers. I don't know if any of these 34 people were handicapped either. I kind of doubt it. But I guess I don't know. I don't see the data.
So I just was trying to get a flavor of the discussion, and I'll come down and help you get trails. I love trails. So and we were visiting in Martin County a long time ago, and folks were asking, and I'm surprised to hear we still don't have them.
And I have had reports, you know, I actually heard a person with a wheelchair just with tears of joy that rode the Loose Line Trail, and that's wonderful. I'm glad. I don't know if we need another trail.
I think we have five bills to go yet this period, and we've got about 40 minutes to go. Somebody had to ask for those trails. We'll find out who they were.
Somebody had to what?
Someone in Hutchinson area had to ask for those trails to happen.
Well,
they didn't immediately come out of the air, I'm sure.
Well, I could answer that for you sometime, but yeah, sometime. It's certainly not the people or taxpayers. Yeah. Thank you.
But he didn't come down. He's saying no. He's waving at me.
Hi there, Madam Chairman.
Gunther is before us, and Representative Gunther moves House File 706 before the committee and recommends that it be referred to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I think we also have an amendment to the bill. You should have it in your packets, everybody. It's labeled DE1. This amendment is to get the bill in the shape that Representative Gunther would like. Any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Hagmeier will give us the information on the amendment.
Sure, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. The DE amendment just kind of clarifies how we currently calculate the 5% reserve or whatever percent reserve we have, tying it to the tax receipts instead of the entire fund balance. And it also ties it to the current fiscal year. So it does the same thing that your bill did with the 95%. It avoids a compounding problem we have and just makes it a little clearer that it's for the current year and the tax receipts.
Basically, to be real quick about it, because we've got a time constraint, this bill creates a statutory requirement that each of the four legacy funds maintain a 5% reserve, which will protect against fund deficits. We have several that are already in fund deficits, and we want to avoid that. And that's basically the bill.
Representative Torkelson has a question.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gunther, you know, some of our appropriations are two-year appropriations, and really the problem has been created in when the second year's funding falls are the expected receipts aren't there in the second year of the biennium. How do you anticipate we address that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Torkelson, the one that is 2 years, the legacy, the Lazard Sams, they're very good at making sure they have 5% in there. Right on stuff. So we assume they're going to continue to do the same.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Lazard Sams is an annual appropriation. Other appropriations are two-year appropriations. And are you suggesting we hold an extra reserve for the second year? I'm not quite tracking.
Two of the legacy funds were predicted to have a deficit, the Arts and the Cultural Heritage Fund and Parks and Trail Fund. I have included letters in your folders for management and budget explaining the predicted deficits. The bill will help prevent deficits in the future. So that's what we're trying to get accomplished.
Yeah.
Very good.
President Torkelson.
I'm done.
You're done? A further explanation by our researcher.
Madam Chair, just to clarify how the DE is written, it says in any fiscal year. Mm-hmm. So for the biennial appropriations, we have both 18 and 19's appropriations. We would track it as a 5% reserve for fiscal year 18, and it wouldn't compound into 19. There would be a separate 5% reserve in fiscal year 19. So it would be a 5% reserve in each year, not just a 5% total, but it would be kind of corrected in the second year to adjust for the appropriations in the first year. So it wouldn't be a 10% amount the second,
right.
It's still 5% the second year. Yep.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. Any further presentation, Representative Gunther?
I will remove my motion to have House File 706 be sent to Ways and Means.
Is that the amendment?
Okay, I think, you know what?
As amended.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, you got it.
I think we reversed the order. So let's first. Is there any further discussions on the amendment to the bill? Okay. No. See, no further discussion. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All those in favor, say nay. Okay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So now you can renew your motion to
have House File 706 be sent to Ways and Means.
Okay. So, Representative Gunther moves that House File 706, which is before you, be passed and as amended and passed on to Ways and Means. All those opposed say aye.
Aye.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. Not all those aye. Opposed. All those opposed say nay. Okay. The motion prevails, and it was on its way to Ways and Means. So now the next bill, Representative Gunther, you ready for 707? Representative Gunther moves House File 707, which is before the committee, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the legacy omnibus bill. Again, we have an amendment that Representative Gunther would move to get the bill in the shape he likes. Everyone have the amendment in your packet. And let's take the amendment first before we launch into the bill.
Mr. Hubinger will explain the amendment.
Yep. Let's go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The amendment would take the appropriation to the LCCMR out of the bill. That portion of that, their portion of that cost for maintaining the website is being carried in their bill.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Okay, the motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Gunther, would you like to present your bill and introduce your testifiers?
The bill provides funding for the Legacy website, and I have testifiers here, Greg and Sally, to explain how that's done.
Madam Chair and members, just a sentence of introduction. When the legislature was...
Excuse me, could you introduce yourself for the record? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. When the legislature was meeting in 2009 after the Legacy Amendment was passed, there was a lot of commitment and interest in being transparent about how these new dollars were going to be spent. And so there was a proposal to develop a website that would show where all of the money spent by all four legacy funds and the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, where all of those proceeds were being distributed. And so that assignment came to our office via statute. Sally Olson of our office maintains that website, manages it, and she has a brief presentation.
Please proceed and introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Sally Olson, and I am with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. As Greg mentioned, in 2009, the LCC was tasked with developing and maintaining a website that showed how legacy and Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund dollars have been used throughout the state. As we developed this website, our objectives were to provide transparency for the public on how the funds were being spent, to provide a variety of ways for visitors to access the data, provide a big picture view of the funding, to provide information on how to apply for funding, and we wanted to create a site that the agency staff could easily update, maintain, and understand. We contracted with a vendor to develop and design the website and underlying database. We worked closely with an advisory group consisting of staff from agencies receiving legacy and trust fund appropriations, as well as staff from LCCMR and Lazard SAMS on the design and development of the website. We knew the website would have a lot of information to display, so we wanted the design to be straightforward, clear, and concise. We wanted the site to be structured so the information was decipherable, and we wanted the site to have a good balance of text and graphics. The Legacy website launched in January of 2011. So what's on the website? Currently, there's information on more than 16,000 funded projects. These projects range from $1 million restoration project to a $300 grant to an individual artist. All the project data can be exported into a CSV or spreadsheet so a user can analyze it in that form as well. You can also find information on how the funds have been appropriated, information relating to each of the specific funds, and direction on how to apply for funding. The statute requires the state agencies that receive the funding report the specific project data to the website. There are staff from 18 different agencies that report this data. There are three different methods that they can use to report. There's an online data entry form, which I think is on the screen. We also developed an API tool, which allows an agency to import data directly into the Legacy website database from their own database. And some agencies will submit a spreadsheet to our office of all the project data, and we will upload the information to the website for them. In fiscal year 14 and 15, we received additional funding to make updates to the website. This included the addition of an interactive project map. The development of this feature was kind of a dual effort. Our vendor did the back-end coding and developed a geocoding tool, which converts an address into coordinates. And then our own LCC GIS staff developed the user interface that you can see a snapshot of there. And that user interface actually got some national recognition. They received the Cartography and Geographic Information Society Award for Best Interactive Map in 2015, which sounds like I don't really know what that is either. But previous winners were the National Geographic and the New York Times, so they're in the company of some pretty big names. We also made the site responsive, so it works across desktop, tablet, and mobile devices, and added some dynamic infographics to the appropriations page to tell the story of how the appropriations were made in a more engaging format. The Legacy website was developed in what is called Drupal 6 as its content management system. That hasn't been upgraded since the site was developed in 2010, and unfortunately that CMS is no longer supported, which means they're not doing security updates and other things. So we've been advised we should upgrade the CMS to Drupal 8. And then finally, we anticipate over the course of the next few years to continue to provide general website maintenance as needed, security updates, software updates, and database administration. And that's pretty much a summary.
Thank you very much. Any other presenters on this particular bill? Representative Torkelson has a question.
Chair, I don't know why I'm so full of questions today. I just can't help myself.
That's good. We need questions.
To the testifier, was this developed in-house or did Minute help you develop this website?
Well, we used a vendor. Minute did not help us develop this website. We used an outside vendor.
Thank you.
Other questions? Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. If there is no further discussion and there's no further questions, then House File 707 will be laid over as amended for possible inclusion in the legacy omnibus bill.
Thank you.
We're going to switch the agenda around a little bit today, and we're going to ask Representative Hansen to come up next.
I'll move House File 198 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and we have a time constraint, so if you could move fast, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for moving us up. Anticipated a constituent from West St. Paul, but I don't think they're here, or maybe they're still on their way. So I apologize if that was the rationale for moving us up, but I haven't heard from them as to where they are. This bill, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you've heard variations, I think, Representative Murphy, since 2009 on inflow infiltration. And rather than having a PowerPoint, I'm just handing out a paper copy, and I have the Metro Cities Association here to walk through, as is Met Council, about this. What I'd like to say here is, you know, you're going to have some folks who are going to say this is not an appropriate use of clean water funds. But we have broke the seal on this in 2013, where $500,000 was spent. And I can tell you that $500,000 was well spent because it was prioritized to areas of need, both in terms of water quality and from cost. In the governor's bonding bill, you will see money for inflow infiltration, but that can only go for the public infrastructure. The private infrastructure, that pipe that goes from the public pipe to the house, is not applicable for bonding. So the only source of revenue that could come for that at this time, unless there was general fund, would be legacy dollars and clean water money. With inflow infiltration problems, you have an impact on water, a potential impact on water quality. It's no different than what you may find elsewhere in the state. And I know it's been said that, well, why do we want to spend money for cost share for people who may be wealthy or live in the city? I can tell you in my district in West St. Paul, there are homes that there's elderly homeowners on fixed income living in the house that was built in the 1930s, and the clay pipe that connects that home is old as well. The home cost or the value of those homes is not wealthy. These are folks who are not wealthy, but they may be in a home that needs water quality improvement through inflow infiltration. So I'd ask for your support on this, and I have Mr. Vanderarnde here to speak about it.
Welcome to the committee. Could you ask me one question, Mr. Vanderarnde? Could this be handled by Public Facilities Administration money?
Mr. Chairman, Charlie Vanderarnde from Metro Cities. I believe when you look at eligibility for PFA money and the past practice of PFA money, that cities in the Metro generally tend not to qualify or are eligible for those. So we're working through the Metropolitan Council in the Metro region for these funds.
Okay. We'll have your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Vanderarnde from Metro Cities, an association of 90 cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. Metro City supports House File 198 to appropriate money from the Clean Water Fund to assist metro area communities with inflow and infiltration mitigation. INI is surges of clean water and storm water that gets into the sanitary sewer, often because of deteriorating pipes or inappropriate or illegal sewer connections. The issue has significant implications for regional water quality and environmental safety. Inflow and infiltration mitigation are consistent with statutory goals for the Clean Water Fund to protect, enhance, and restore water quality, to protect groundwater from degradation, and to protect drinking water sources. Correcting inflow and infiltration has an important role in ensuring that our region's drinking water resources are not wasted and to help avoid sewage spills and overflows into regional wastewater pipes, lakes, and homes, all of which have major impacts on water quality and public safety. INI mitigation provides direct benefits to water quality by assisting with actual repairs to identified local public and private infrastructure contributing to this problem. Over 70 communities have been identified as contributing excess clean water, or INI, into the regional wastewater system. Current capacity in wastewater pipes is not sufficient to manage excess levels of clean water that makes its way into regional pipes not designed for that purpose. On the private or homeowner side of this issue, which these funds would help to address, many private property owners may not be aware of problems with their pipes, so either ignore it or end up making only minor fixes, which increases environmental risks and eventually higher public infrastructure costs. Proactive management of this issue works to assure that local governments, businesses, and the public avoid unnecessary expenses associated with environmental and safety impacts associated with such spills. This appropriation would aid in protecting water quality, drinking water, and groundwater, and would provide immediate environmental and economic benefits to the metropolitan region. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had one comment and one question. If you're not familiar with the clay pipes, I can tell you that they're a disaster. Most of them are many, many years old, and I've heard stories from plumbers where they've gone in to clean out a clay pipe and actually had their auger go through the pipe and go out into the dirt, and so it's a severe problem. I understand that. You have $5 million, and so I would assume that there's a lot of houses just in your area, but not only there, across the state. How far is $5 million going to go?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Green. Not very far. Really, the $5 million could be spent in West St. Paul alone, but the process that happened last time these dollars were available is it got distributed throughout the metropolitan area through the Met Council. And I think maybe Representative Freiberg may be familiar with that, that it went out. I think that at that time West St. Paul got $40,000. So it hit the very worst situations with cost share for the individual homeowner. So it's not going to go that far. This is a long-term issue. And again, the public infrastructure is also part of this, where hopefully there will be bonding dollars for that. It's a big issue throughout the metro area, and particularly in older communities.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any, for the private homeowners, is there any, income assessment? I mean, I think when we bought our house, I paid to have the street torn up, and, I paid for it, which was fine. I mean, but do we have any limitations on how this money goes out? Because it seems silly to pay for people that can actually pay for it themselves.
Perhaps the Metropolitan Council could answer the technical question of the grants.
Mr. Chair.
We have two more bills up yet, so please be quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jason Willith, I'm an assistant general manager with the Environmental Services Division of the Council. I was finance director the last time this program had money. The process that we go through involves, first of all, looking at whatever strings are attached with the appropriation. So if you were to put that string on there, then we would have that constraint. And then we work with authors and particularly Metro Cities, who has been a proponent of this in the past, and kind of come up with a staff bill to propose. We then have public meetings with Metro Cities and a formal public meeting at the council. At any point, that could be changed or improved. All of that happens before the Met Council actually approves the guidelines of the program. So the short answer to your question is it could have But we would want to work with our customers to see if that was what they wanted to do with the money.
Okay. Mr. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll keep this very short, just recognizing the time limitations, but thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this forward. And I appreciated the question from Representative Green there that this doesn't go very far, so I'm glad to hear Representative Green advocating for greater public spending on this program. In my city, in Golden Valley, we have poor soils, a lot of older homes, kind of like what you're describing too, and I know, and we've implemented a pretty aggressive program. If you actually sell your house, everybody who sells a house has to get this scoped, and if there's a problem, get it repaired. So a lot of people took advantage of this program in Golden Valley, and I know the last time we did this, the funds didn't were expended pretty quickly because it was a big interest in Golden Valley. So thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Anybody in the audience have a question? Quick question. You got a statement? Love to have your statements, too.
Greetings, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Trevor Russell. I'm the Water Program Director with Friends of the Mississippi River. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and restoring the Mississippi River. Our organization is one of 21 signatories so far on a letter that I believe has been passed out to committee members. I have about five extra copies, so I can pass them out or give them to folks in the audience. My testimony today is not really specific to this bill, but broadly to legislation allocating Clean Water Fund money that doesn't align with the Clean Water Fund recommendations of the Clean Water Council. In 2008, we passed the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. About a third of that money goes to the Clean Water Fund. And the Clean Water Council is charged under Minnesota Statute 114D.30 Subdivision 6 with recommending to the legislature how money from the Clean Water Fund should be appropriated. In addition to supporting the Clean Water Council's recommendations because of their value to Minnesota's water resources, we asked legislators to honor these Clean Water Council recommendations for reasons related to their good process. The council is a 28-member council. It includes Representative Torkelson and now I believe Representative Wagenius as well. It also includes diverse outdoor hunting, fishing, recreational organizations and organizations from across the state that are stakeholders in clean water, along with the University of Minnesota and Met Council. The result is the council's composition results in legislative participation and informed citizenry, and we think a very effective vetting process. Second, and I'll be brief, the council adopted a rigorous slate of guiding principles and funding priorities used to make these recommendations. They get many more requests for clean water funds than can possibly be funded through the Clean Water Fund. We think they do a really good job of filtering or evaluating those proposals based on these guiding principles and funding priorities and trying to find the best, most effective projects first. Third, I think the council has made a really deliberate effort to make that process more inclusive and transparent. Folks are invited many times along the way to be able to provide comment or address the council directly. I've done so myself twice this year for over an hour each time. And then lastly, I think the legislature has traditionally relied on the expertise of the Clean Water Council, legislative and non-legislative stakeholders to craft science-based, nonpartisan Clean Water Fund recommendations that that apply the Clean Water Fund dollars to the best projects to try to get us as far to our clean water goals as we possibly can. We're not naive. We know the Clean Water Fund alone isn't going to restore all of Minnesota's surface waters, but we believe this nonpartisan, multi-stakeholder-based, really rigorous process gets us the best set of recommendations possible. While we certainly support many of the individual projects that have been brought forward and will be brought forward here today, we think the legislature and the people of Minnesota are best served by adhering as closely as possible to the Clean Water Fund recommendations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Give your name for the record.
Right, thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Daryl Gerber, and I'm with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And just a couple things to add to what Trevor mentioned is one of them is to look back at the purpose of the Clean Water Fund and even before that, the Clean Water Legacy Act. And really both of them came about because due to the slow pace of water quality improvements and the work meant to get those improvements, the state was actually at a pretty tough spot where it was not going to be able to issue water discharge permits across much of the state. And because of that kind of pickle that we were in, we took some very serious steps to really address that. And have to remember back to that the priorities are for water assessments, to identify those pollution sources, to develop the plans on how to clean those up, and to make sure that those actions that are needed to address those problems are taken in a timely manner. And so it really asks that, you know, the committee really keep that in mind when really evaluating these programs. And part of the thing is the substitution issue that you probably heard about is think about what are the other funding sources. In the case of many of these, kind of looking forward on one of the bills, there's drainage system assessments are funds that are already available to do work in public drainage systems. And in this case, there are local fees for water, for wastewater treatment, as well as assessments that the Met Council can do some of this really important work, but really making sure that this fund is used to go above and beyond and take those steps to clean up our waters as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg.
I know we're really short on time, so I just have a yes-no question for the testifiers, followed by a comment. Does improving sewer infrastructure through reducing inflow and infiltration improve water quality?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it likely does.
Okay. I think, you know, just the word you used was recommendation, that the Clean Water Council makes a recommendation. It's not binding. I know the cat's already been out of the bag in 2015. We spent $11 million for soil and water districts, which was not in the Clean Water Council recommendations. I think this is a valid program, and I think we should consider this one, too.
Thank you. House File 198 will be laid over for inclusion, possible inclusion. Representative Murphy?
Thank you.
I'm sorry. We didn't get you in there quicker. Go for it. You're up.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy lays over House File 151, or moves House File 151 for possible inclusion in the Legacy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like an amendment from the Clean Water Fund to the Arts and Cultural Fund, Heritage Fund.
Okay. Oral amendment.
With me today is former Representative Jack LaVoy, preceding my time. And Sarah Erickson from the Lake Superior Aquarium, or the Lake Superior Center Authority, and they're requesting $350,000 for a new display. Mm-hmm. And their last display was so great that kids are petting fish. And their other display was a national winner.
I hope they aren't bullheads. They sting.
But they will tell you about the merits of that in 4 minutes.
Okay.
Go for it. Give your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jack LaVoy. I'm Executive Director at Great Lakes Aquarium in Duluth, and I'm here with Sarah Erickson, our Director of Education. We're actually here on behalf of Lake Superior Center Authority, which was created by Session Laws 1990 to provide a focus on Lake Superior and freshwater education. The authority, in turn, has contracted with us, which is Lake Superior Center, doing business at Great Lakes Aquarium, to run the day-to-day operations of the aquarium and to also represent it before the legislature. We're here to provide an overview of an exciting new project that we will focus on the importance rivers play in the ecological landscape. But first, permit me to introduce you to Great Lakes Aquarium. Great Lakes Aquarium is Duluth's number one paid visitor attraction, hosting over 140,000 people per year. Approximately 60% of those come from the Northland, northeastern Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and about 40% or about 60,000 people come each year from outside of our region, primarily the metropolitan area. Our facility offers people of all ages the opportunity to explore, learn about, play, and connect with Lake Superior and the waters of the world. We have benefited from past investments from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which have dramatically enhanced the visitor's experience in our facility. In fiscal year 2014, we received a $200,000 investment. We're able to leverage into a $535,000 new exhibit called Shipwrecks Alive, where we explore the role shipwrecks play, not as they sink, but afterwards as underwater habitat. And as Representative Murphy pointed out, we were pleased that is an exhibit that we conceived, designed, and built ourselves, and we were pleased that we found in a national competition put on by the National Association for Interpretation, we received the National Second Place Award for the Best Interior Exhibit Design. In fiscal year 2016, we received $250,000 investment, which we levered into a $726,000 project called Unsalted Seas, focused on large lakes of the world, of which we have the largest. And among its many attractions is the largest sturgeon touch tank in North America. And photo examples of each of those past exhibits are on the last four pages of this handout. The arts and cultural heritage investments in our facility have not only improved our visitors' experience, but it's significantly improved our bottom line as well. In each of the last several years, we've set new attendance records, each outdoing the year before, and grown our annual income proportionally. So I'd like to call on Sarah Erickson now to give you an overview of this latest vision, which we hope you will consider for funding.
Sarah, well, let us get our amendment so we get the money coming out of the right places. You want to give us that?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would be on line 1.5, delete clean water and insert arts and cultural heritage.
Everybody understand the amendment? All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Passed. Now go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Sarah Erickson. I'm the Education Director at Great Lakes Aquarium. A quick overview. We have a more robust story in the handout you have in front of you. We're really hoping to tell the story of rivers in Minnesota. It's a natural fit for our facility and for our communities. Minnesota is home to the headwaters of three different watersheds, water flowing along major tributaries to the south along the Mississippi, to the east through the St. Louis River, close to where we are, and through the Red River watershed to the north. So rivers are really at the center, are really a huge part of Minnesota's water legacy, and connecting people to waterways is really what we do, the work we do, in collaboration with our community. We are looking to provide our visitors with an immersive and vibrant and personal experience. We engage conversations that lead from fish to childhood memories to changes in landscape and actions people can take to restore and protect these vital assets in our state. This exhibit will be a gathering place for people to celebrate and learn more about waterways that move through all of our communities. We often get requests from visitors that are interested in seeing large river species, things like northern pike and paddlefish. This exhibit would, or this funding would help us provide that for our community. It would really enable us to showcase these fish from a unique perspective rather than at the end of the line, really going about their day as fish, getting that inside view. It also would enable us to bring back the resident bald eagle to tell a story of rivers as a migration pathway. Currently, that eagle is in a semi-off-exhibit space. Visitors don't have a great chance to see him, and this would provide an indoor-outdoor exhibit that allows weathering and exposure to the elements. So rivers really are at the center of a lot of wildlife stories, but they're also at the center of human stories, and we're hoping to share both of those things in tandem. Together, we work really closely, as our handout suggests and past exhibits suggest, with regional artists and scientists and storytellers to design and fabricate these one-of-a-kind award-winning displays. And this space is used by many, by community groups, by schools, by special events coming to our space, and by the general public to really learn, play, and celebrate Minnesota's water legacy together. So we really hope that you consider supporting this project. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you for a wonderful presentation. Any questions? Quickly. Slowly. Would the audience like to say anything?
Representative Freiberg?
Just want to say a few years ago we did the Legacy Committee actually did a tour and we stopped by the aquarium and it was a great facility. I was impressed with it. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That space you met with us in now is part of the Unsalted Seas. It's quite a beautiful transformation.
I will renew Representative Murphy's amendment. House file 151 has amended to be laid over for possible inclusion of legacy. Phil, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
And Representative Green will have yours coming up next Monday, along with, as of next week, we will start having night meetings because we're going to have so many bills that are coming out of my ears. So with that, we're adjourned.